Hello and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy, where we strive to relate, educate, and innovate one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. In addition to featuring unique conversation and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Step inside, take a seat, let's explore the world of therapy like never before. Dr. Eli's here, bringing voices so bright, innovating, relating, and shedding new light. It's AAMFT, where wisdom meets passion. Come listen and see, talking trends, deep insights, and stories so bold. For MFT minds, the future unfolds. Systemic, my friends, we relate, educate, and innovate again. Stay systemic, my friends. Stay systemic, my friends. Stay systemic, my friends. We relate, educate, and innovate again, one episode at a time. At a time.
Therapists often find their bereaved clients struggle to cope with the death of a loved one in ways that vary greatly between individuals and different family systems. One person may find it difficult to express the emotional facets of grief, whereas another may have a hard time maintaining a meaningful connection to the deceased. And still another may stumble while adapting to changes in their family post-death. In this episode of the AAMFT podcast, I am joined by Dr. Paul Martin as he articulates a new model for how bereaved individuals can create unique expressions of mourning that are tailored to their psychological needs and grounded in memories and emotions specific to the relationship they lost. We're going to examine cultures across the world and throughout history to shed light on how humanity has always turned to grief rituals and how customs can stifle one's pursuit of healthy and meaningful mourning. Contemporary psychological research, most notably attachment theory, which we'll draw from today, provides an in-depth understanding of how each individual's subjective experience of loss varies and why complicated bereavement may emerge. Paul's going to share some great clinical stories that exemplify innovative strategies for designing, customizing personal grief rituals. His current book from Routledge, Personal Grief Rituals, is an excellent resource for any therapist out there working with bereaved clients and client systems. Students, MFTs, whether you are young or seasoned, this is a book that really helps. Dr. Paul Martin is a licensed clinical psychologist, and he is the assistant director of the Center for Grief Recovery. Paul received his doctorate in clinical psychology from the Chicago School of Professional Psychology and has completed a fellowship in the study of psychoanalysis through the Chicago Center of Psychoanalysis. Paul specializes in individual psychotherapy for those struggling with loss and grief. He uses a variety of psychodynamic, existential and behavioral interventions to help people recover from traumatic loss and overcome complicated bereavement. This is an episode that I think almost everyone, no matter your theoretical orientation, will be able to draw something from. I know the book has helped me in my work with bereaved clients and in my own grief. Can't wait to hear what you think. We will be back after our interview with Paul. Eli, back with you on the AAMFT podcast. So happy to be joined by Dr. Paul Martin. And today we are talking about a topic often requested, and many can argue that systemic therapists, unless they've had specialized training, don't get exposed to enough, and that's grief work. And while we've done shows on grief in the past, we are today combining grief with something very near and dear to the heart of many classic systemic couple and family therapists, which is ritual. So we're talking about grief rituals with Paul, and he literally wrote the book on it. But Paul, the first question is always, we'd like to know our expert. Tell us about your therapeutic origin story, and specifically, how did you get interested in working with grief?
Sure. Thank you, by the way. It's really lovely to be talking with you today. Oh, where to begin? So I suppose this story begins with me doing my graduate work and my graduate training and just realizing that anytime a case came my way that had something to do with loss and grief, I found myself really comfortable doing the work. And I also found it incredibly fascinating. I started to request more cases that pertained to loss and grief in some way. And then by the time I was done with graduate school, I wrote my dissertation on a topic that was loosely related to loss. And then once I was done with getting my license and everything, I joined a practice called the Center for Grief Recovery in Chicago. And as the name suggests, the majority of the work that we do there pertains to loss, grief, and mourning. As far as my interest in grief rituals, what I'll say about that briefly is that I started to notice two big things early in my professional clinical work. The first was that I would take note anytime my clients made mention of some really specific subjective experience that they had through the mourning process. For instance, they would talk about how important it was for them to do certain things that allowed them to feel close to their deceased loved ones in some way. So I'd make note of that. I'd also make note of really curious things like people saying, I'm afraid to get a haircut because I worry that if he comes back, he won't recognize me. And so I just kept making note of these really interesting subjective experiences to try to just get at the importance of helping clients talk about and enact something that felt very personally meaningful to them. On top of that, what I started to also observe is that some of my clients would talk about how their communities or their culture as a whole would provide grief rituals that were incredibly helpful to them. And conversely, I would hear a lot of stories as well from people who were talking about how they had the opposite experience. There is something about the workplace or their family or their church or their community as a whole, something about the grief rituals that were available that not only failed to help, but in some instances, outright presented complications, made it difficult for them to grieve and mourn. So all of that together is the reason why I started to write this book called Personal Grief Rituals. And 7 years later, the thing finally got done.
It was a labor of love and one drawn from your direct clinical experience, which I think is great. Our listeners love to hear clinical stories and what this looks like actually in a therapy room. But first, what do our listeners need to know about cultural grief rituals in the mourning process from a historical, cultural, anthropological perspective?
There's a lot to say about that, of course, but I think anybody who's interested in this topic, they need to know that we have evidence dating back hundreds of thousands of years, really, that suggests that human beings have always engaged in some kind of ritualistic activity while burying or cremating the deceased. So this goes back a long way in our history. And when you look back to cultures, as far back as the ancient Egyptians, it's apparent that they too were engaged in grief rituals on a very regular basis. Now, what's really interesting to me when you zoom out and look at history as a whole, and when you look at different cultures across time and across space, what you start to see is that different cultures grieve in completely different ways. Their grief rituals are built upon wildly different belief systems about how to think about death and what is necessary for the mourning process. there are some commonalities that emerge, and we can maybe talk about that later. But I'll just leave it at that for right now, that if you look at how people in Japan have used grief rituals over time, it's going to look wildly different from how people in Australia have grieved, how people in Madagascar use grief rituals, and how the Aztecs in Mexico used grief rituals 500 years ago.
As I was saying earlier, I think a lot of therapists, unless they've had specialized experience like you and work at a place that is the focus of your professional practice and you're working with like-minded others, many therapists don't have this training and therefore leads to a lot of misconceptions around grief and specifically what we're talking about today, grief rituals. What in educating not only your clients and the public that you work with, but also therapists that are expanding their scope of competence, so to speak, what do you think some of those biggest misconceptions about grief rituals out there that exist?
Yeah, there are many. So I'll try to go through them succinctly. The first I'd say is that in terms of denial, which you hear a lot about, especially in terms of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's well-known model, I think it's incredibly rare to find somebody who's experiencing capital D denial. Most people are incredibly aware of the reality of exactly what has happened and who they have lost. Denial emerges in some really subtle ways. The bereaved find themselves picking up the phone and beginning the process of calling their father who recently died. For instance, the person who's coming into therapy is there willingly because they obviously know that they lost somebody. But they'll find that they avoid certain activities that would drive home the reality a little further. So that's the first thing I'd highlight, that there are a lot of ways in which grief rituals help the bereaved confront the reality of loss, not because they are blatantly in denial of what has happened, but because they're not really processing it on a deeper level. The other big thing I'd say about grief therapy as a whole, really, is that I sometimes worry that therapists and counselors of all stripes, I worry that they believe that every bereaved individual that you see should be expressing emotions at all times, whenever possible. That is the case for a lot of people that you end up working with. But there are some bereaved individuals who, because of their attachment style, because of their temperament, maybe because of something really specific to the relationship they lost, they're actually struggling with complicated bereavement because they're expressing emotions with too much frequency and too much intensity. And all of this that I'm talking about really gets to the idea of, if you are going to help a client design a grief ritual, what I call a personal grief ritual, it's important to keep in mind that it has to be catered to their unique needs. And that's the last big thing I'll highlight for right now. In terms of misconceptions about grief rituals, I hear all too often that therapists with good intention will recommend generic ideas. Go light a candle. Go throw some ashes in a body of water. Write a letter to the deceased. Yeah, that's right. And it sounds lovely at face value, but if you're asking somebody to write a letter to the deceased, maybe what you're failing to take into consideration is the fact that they're already a bit too preoccupied having imaginary or illusory conversations with the deceased. So you're just fanning the flames by saying, why don't you go write a letter? It's, yeah, they're already thinking about the deceased too much. They're already struggling to interact with everybody else around them in the world. Another example of that is you might ask somebody to release ashes into a body of water so as to let go. Maybe what they would benefit from, if you actually listen to them, is a grief ritual that allows them not to let go, but to hold on in some meaningful way. And lastly, you might tell somebody, go plant a tree or light a candle. And that may very well just be a completely meaningless, vapid exercise for them that doesn't touch upon anything that is personally meaningful to them, anything about the specific relationship they lost, and it might fail to actually get at their psychological needs and what it is that they need in order to move through the mourning process in a more healing and meaningful way.
All right, let's build off that. So I think sometimes people will come, especially to you because of where you work and how you are known in the field. Their presenting problem is almost always grief. Many times, especially in the world of couple or family therapy, a partner says, hey, my spouse, my husband, my wife, and I'll use an example that came in my office last week. We're doing this couple work and it's great, but hey, Eli, my husband lost his dad a year ago and he's never really dealt with it. I think he should have some type of ritual, but they say, I love my father. I'm good. I don't think I really need it. How do you create a framework or sell the benefit of rituals as a thing that could offer comfort and solace to a person that is experiencing grief? How do you get the buy-in if they say, no, I'm good. I don't really need a ritual?
Yeah, first of all, a lot of people have some natural misgivings about the word ritual and the whole concept of it, right? For a lot of people, it's going to bring to mind negative and weird connotations of sorcery and people doing animal sacrifices around a campfire in the middle of a forest or something like that. And even in the psychological community, a lot of the time when somebody utters the word ritual, they're talking about something having to do with obsessive compulsive disorder. And
it has a pathological connotation.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So first and foremost, I've found it helpful to put aside any concerns about how they're going to be invited or asked to do something really weird, like a seance or something where they feel like they have to wash their hands 55 times in a row or anything weird like that. For most people, a personal grief ritual is actually incredibly straightforward. It doesn't involve anything incredibly weird. And that is especially the case if you invite the client to design it with you. Like in the case that you brought up, if somebody at work or in somebody's family suggests that they take part in a ritual, that's going to create a problem that can sometimes occur in cultural grief rituals as well, which is that the bereaved find themselves in a passive position. They don't feel like they're having any choice in what they're doing. They aren't exerting any agency in their decision about what their grief feels like, what would be meaningful to them, what it is they need to do to mourn in a healthier and more meaningful way. So I always put a strong emphasis on this idea that I am not going to just fling some solution at them. I'm not going to tell them, go do this as a grief ritual. I invite them to talk about, is there any aspect of what has changed that you need to confront? Are there any particular emotions that you're having a hard time expressing? Is there any way, shape, and form in which you feel like you need to move forward? And lastly, is there any desire to maintain what some people would call a continuing bond? Whenever I go through that list, and by the way, that's loosely built off William Worden's task model of mourning, for anyone's interested. Whenever I go through that short list, it's almost always the case that somebody's ears perk up a little bit in response to the one of them, and they say, you know what, that's really interesting, because I haven't been able to drive by the street where the car accident happened. I haven't been able to express anger. I do feel like I haven't been able to move forward. Or I do feel like I want some meaningful ongoing connection to the person I lost, and I don't know how to go about doing it. And then you're inviting a conversation with them about what they would like to do for a grief ritual that would be helpful and meaningful to them.
Yeah, I love those series of checkpoints and questions in order to open the dialogue and maybe get someone that would balk at the word ritual. And I like the idea of a communal bond. Other wording that is less pathological, when I've talked to clients about this, that I agree would be turned off by the term ritual. I like things of a way of honoring or a remembrance or any other languaging that you have used that helps people connect to the spirit of what you're talking about?
Yeah, there are times where I will try to avoid overuse of the word ritual, because you can tell people get a little squeamish when they hear that. Fine, fair enough. In those cases, I like to resort to some version of my own definition of what a grief ritual is. A specific sequence of actions grounded in meaning about loss and mourning that gives symbolic expression to thoughts and feelings about the loss. That, I think, gets at the essence of what a ritual is. And again, it invites the client to have a straightforward conversation. Even if they have some misgivings about the word ritual, we can talk simply about things like, what actions do you think would be helpful? How are you making sense of this? And what is the meaning that you want to tie in to the mourning process? Are there specific thoughts you want to articulate and enact? Are there certain feelings you want to enact? Once you get at those different ideas, yeah, most clients can start to warm up to the idea that this is something that they'd be happy to work with you to create, and it's something that they feel would be helpful.
So now we're getting into ways a therapist would co-construct or collaborate with a client or a client system to develop one of these grief rituals. You've already told us, don't do any boilerplate suggestions. You have to know the person. Let's, in this case, use the example of somebody is grieving someone that is deceased. How much do you need to know about that relationship to help co-construct or collaborate on a ritual?
I, of course, want to hear, you know, as much from them as I can about the relationship they had with them early in life, if it changed, if it progressed for better or for worse. I want to hear specifics about, what kind of things did you guys do together? In what ways did you bond? I certainly want to talk to my clients about the possibility that there may be some hard feelings, because maybe there was something about the relationship that was strained. And so once I get that information from them, that helps to avoid the generic boilerplate kind of rituals that you and I have been talking about today. And now we can get into things that are really specific to the relationship they lost, that they are mourning. So if the person had a pretty good relationship with the deceased, but there is something that they're angry about, okay, we might need to hone in on that particular emotion and find a way to express that. If the individual is looking for some meaningful way of maintaining an abstract connection to them, once again, we're talking about that idea of continuing bonds, I would want to know specifics about, did you guys read books together? Did you go golfing together? Were you both avid rock climbers, or anything like that gets at how we could use those activities that they did together. We could build upon what was meaningful about their relationship to create a grief ritual that is meaningful. And I guess the last thing I'll say for right now is that I really want to know about the quality of the relationship, because there are some instances in which, if you're not careful, you, the clinician, will make the mistake of assuming that you're really upset that they're gone. You must be feeling sad about their absence. And what you may very well find is that the individual had an incredibly strained relationship with the deceased. Maybe there was something that was even outright toxic or abusive about the relationship. And part of what they need to work through is their sense that the community as a whole is telling them, we should mourn and we should be sad, but that person actually wants greater distance from that relationship. They don't want to write a letter to them. They don't want to do anything that's going to allow them to feel closer. They very much want to establish greater distance from what may have been a bad chapter in their life. So that's a really dramatic example of why. Yeah, it's a good question. I very much want to gather all the information that I can about the quality of the relationships so that I know what it is that we're trying to help them better express, and what it is that we're trying to help them do by designing a personal grief ritual.
I love that last point that you made, because sometimes the cultural grief practice is not in agreement, is very discordant with what the client needs. So if someone, yes, was maybe revered in his or her community, but had a strained relationship with the person that is bereaved, the person that is bereaved does not want to engage in these cultural things. They want, as you said, more of a boundary and distance. So in situations like that, perhaps the work is, again, validating that for the client and helping them create a boundary, or over time, letting go of those feelings that kind of stick with them to a place where they can be able to at least be neutral around about the deceased. You do a great job in the book of kind of categorizing these type of rituals, and I will go through them all and you can give some clinical examples from your work. Let's start with, because you said, which I agree, rarely are people in the big D denial. They know this person has gone at smaller pieces of denial that really require acceptance that this person is gone. And somebody told me, I lost my dad when I was 18, and I had a family therapist that had a grief background. That therapist told me that the second year is harder than the first, because you realize that person, you finally accept they're not coming back. You don't have any data or literature to back that up, but I'm curious what you think about that statement about the second year, and then talk about and share some examples of rituals that facilitate acceptance of loss for people that are having problems accepting it.
Yeah. What I love about that anecdote is that it gets at one of the central theses, if you will, that I try to emphasize in my book. We really need to pay attention to the individual and their experience of mourning. So is it true that for some people, the second year is harder? Sure. But we don't want to throw any kind of one size fits all observations or predictions or recommendations in terms of this is what the second year is going to be like for you. For a lot of people, I find the exact opposite, actually. There's something about that first year that involves one confrontation with reality after another. And they get to that second year, and there's some relief in the fact that, you know what, my family has already gone through the holidays that first time without our grandfather. I've already traversed really important dates like the wedding anniversary that I had with my spouse who recently died. I already traversed through other important dates like Mother's Day, Father's Day, their birthday, Halloween, which they really enjoyed, whatever. And so for a lot of people, actually, I find that the second year proves to be a lot easier. Now, some individuals may have a harder time with it because of what you're saying. Maybe the first year just involved an adrenaline rush of helping the family as a whole adjust and just trying to wrap your head around things like how to plan a funeral, how to resolve everything legal having to do with the estate that's been left behind. So for one person, that second year is going to require some kind of work that allows them to confront the reality of their loss a little bit more. And for another person, they're good to go in that sense. They've already confronted reality.
It would seem to me the more in denial, the harder the second year would be. Whereas if you move toward the acceptance of loss earlier and you go through all these things in the first year, you are more prepared. Obviously, you live with grief. You never completely... Well, that's another state. I'm curious what you think about that. People say, oh, it never goes away. You just learn to live with it. What do you think about a statement or an adage like that?
I'm really happy you mentioned that. To be completely honest, that is a pet peeve of mine. So I'm going to have to rein it in a little bit, because I could talk about that at great length.
All right. Give me the quick version, because I you hear that a lot. And again, as we've been saying today, well, it depends on the person. It's not a one size fit all thing, but I am curious your thoughts on that.
That's right. There is certainly something to be said about how if you put pressure on yourself to get over it or be done with grief in some kind of final, decisive way, that can thwart the mourning process for you. That might be the reason why grief rears its head down the road in a really ugly way because you never really dealt with it. You tried to get beyond it too fast. Okay, fair enough. And look, one of my favorowte quotes is from John Bowlby, the father of attachment theory, if you will, who said, "Grief never ends. It only erupts less frequently." I love that because it gets at the idea that grief isn't going to go away. But if we carry that idea to its extreme, what we seem to be implying is, look, this is always going to be heart-wrenching. You're always going to be in a state of grief and mourning. And I think that fails to recognize the fact that some people do naturally get beyond an acute state of grief. They actually do get to a point where they are no longer pained by the fact that somebody who was very meaningful to them died 9 years ago. It might hurt a little bit when they think about it, but that sentiment that you touched upon seems to get at this idea that there is no need ever trying to get beyond this. It will change you and you will carry your grief around with you forever. I think there are plenty of people who demonstrate that they can process their grief in a healthy and meaningful way, and they can get to a point where they have reincorporated themselves back into the world, and they are living an incredibly fulfilling life that is not weighed down by grief and mourning. That's the short version.
So here, I want to give you a chance to give us an example from your work that you think really resonates about a ritual that focuses on facilitating acceptance of loss.
Yeah, and I'd be happy to go with each of these broad categories if you'd like. So yeah, let's start rituals that help to accept the reality of loss. My favorite subset of these type of rituals are what I refer to as searching rituals, which is, it's based in the central tenets of attachment theory that I won't go too deep into right now, but it's basically the idea that we are all born with instinctual attachment behaviors, one of which is to quite literally search for our attachment figures when they leave the room, when they're too far away for our liking. And this is really early in life, right? So the child learns to crawl and ultimately they learn to walk. And then if the parent dares to go to the other side of the apartment, the child doesn't accept that, right? They will go find you. Now, what does that have to do with the mourning process? What John Bowlby astutely observed over half a century ago is that for many people, part of what they experience in the acute state of mourning, that immediate response to loss, is all of those instincts are reactivated. And so for the same reason that a child will cry when they are experiencing too much separation, the bereaved will cry because on some level it feels, if I cry long enough and hard enough, maybe they'll come back. And this idea applies to searching behaviors as well. There's a reason why the bereaved are often compelled to do things like, I felt like I needed to drive by my mother's house, or I just felt like once my employee died, I felt like I needed to go into his office and just almost look for him, almost to confront the fact that he or she is no longer where they used to be. I love building upon that idea because as painful and heart-wrenching as those searching behaviors are when you're in a state of mourning, they're there for a reason. They are designed to help you confront the stark reality that the people you were once attached to in the real external world are no longer there in the form they used to be. So there are times where I find that certain bereaved clients, again, they're not blatantly in a state of denial, but you can tell there are things they're hesitating to do. There are places or even rooms in the house that they aren't going to anymore. And in those instances, I like to help clients design what I call searching rituals. One quick example that comes to mind is that I was working with a mother and a daughter who were grieving the loss of their respective husband and father. And what they started to realize is that there were two rooms in the house that he used to occupy: his office upstairs and the garage where he liked to do various types of handiwork. And the more I talked with them, the more they realized, oh, you're not going in the garage either. I haven't been going in the garage over the last couple months either. Have you been up to his office on the second floor of the house? I haven't. Oh, I haven't either. And so what we all started to realize is they would benefit from making a very intentional plan to go into those rooms, sit there for a while, and just look over all of the things in the room that aren't being used anymore. That for them was the personal grief ritual that we came up with. And they informed me of the important details as far as which room they wanted to start with, where they wanted to sit, what items they wanted to tinker with, and so forth. And I just found that to be such a lovely example of what it means to confront reality on a deeper, more visceral level. And lo and behold, after a couple of weeks of engaging in that personal grief ritual a couple of different times, actually, they both started to feel more comfortable in those rooms. And they both felt in a general way like the grieving and the mourning process was moving forward in a healthier way.
I love that example because grief is not just an individual thing. It's collective within a family system. So here the mother and daughter had these very similar things. So you facilitated a dialogue about their father, husband who was gone, and that ritual was collaborated on and worked for both of them. So it's a beautiful example of how to make a ritual fit for when you have more than one person in the system. Now, you also talk about your second category, rituals that expand or limit emotional experience of loss, depending where they're at. So if I had someone that was shut down from their feelings, I would want to perhaps expand their emotional experience, versus if I had someone that was just a complete puddle of emotion and could not stop, I would probably want to limit their emotional expression. So give us some examples of how you do that.
First of all, we're talking about quantity, how much emotion is being expressed. And for some people, their experience of grief is a bit stifled because they're not allowing themselves to access their emotions at all. And so in those instances, it's pretty straightforward, right? Let's come up with some kind of ritual that is going to coax out more emotion. And again, the best way to go about doing that is to ask your client a whole lot of questions about what was the relationship like? What sort of meaningful memories do you have in relation to that person that you lost? And hopefully you can land on something that is a bit of a tearjerker for them. So for one client of mine, she started to talk about how she and her father always went to Wrigley Field to watch baseball games together. And ever since he died, she hasn't gone. She was a very reticent, very stoic, pragmatic kind of person. But it started to become apparent that whenever she talked about that particular topic, the emotion would just begin to emerge. So I would take those opportunities to invite her to say more, to make sure that she wasn't changing the topic. And lo and behold, that was the topic that would get an emotional response from her. Hey, there we are in talk therapy, talking about going to a baseball game. Great. It became the basis for us talking about her creating a personal grief ritual when we started to talk about how much emotion it would facilitate for her to actually go to a game again. And so for her, the ritual was go through the process of making the plan, getting the tickets, go sit in the bleachers out in left field like they used to do together. And she did that all the meanwhile knowing that it was going to be an emotional experience. And it proved to be exactly that. She half jokingly cursed my name because she was sitting there crying in the bleachers throughout the game, but she was laughing with me about it, all with an understanding. That was incredibly good for me to go do something that pulled for more emotion than what I'm allowing myself to feel. Now, conversely, there are people who need to limit or contain their emotions. And in no way do I want to imply that the goal is to get people to shut down their emotions or not feel them. Rather, the idea is to use what grief rituals often do very well, which is to provide a circumscribed framework for when the ritual begins and when it ends. And so in those instances, I found it helpful to talk with clients about how, okay, they are going to go to the gravesite. They are going to go to the baseball game. They are going to drive by their mother's house. Fine, but it's going to be helpful for them not just to do so spontaneously numerous times a day or numerous times a week, but to make a very clear intention to do so at a specific time and to draw it to a close within a certain amount of time as well, all highlighting that the idea that it's okay to enter into that state of grief and mourning. But for some individuals, it's going to be necessary to quite literally practice drawing it to a close and opening up more space to engage in their life in the here and now. Now, that's all about the quantity of grief. Sometimes what I find so helpful about designing a personal grief ritual with a client is that you're not getting at the quantity of grief so much as you're getting at the quality of it. What I mean by that is this can prove to be a really helpful way of accessing specific emotions that they're having a hard time getting to, especially those emotions that are a bit frowned upon. The two big ones that always stand out to me are anger and happiness. So one of my favorite stories about this that I write about a good amount in the book is a woman who lost her mother, and she found herself understandably walking around in a real acute state of grief, and she felt really sad. But she had this really interesting moment where she was going to a work party and she picked out a new dress and she realized that it was a rather drab mauve kind of color. Me being somebody who doesn't understand the nuances of different colors and fashion, I was genuinely curious with her. I asked, what's so weird about you having picked out a dress that's mauve? And by the way, what is mauve? And she said, it's like a purple, but it's a toned down grayish kind of color. And so again, I asked her, what about that is weird or concerning to you? And she said, my mother always taught me to dress in bright colors. And I feel like ever since she died, I'm walking around almost as if I have to be sad, as if I have to let the world know that I'm sad. But in actuality, what I really feel about my mother's loss, I just feel incredibly grateful for the wonderful influence she had over my life. I am genuinely overjoyed that I had such a loving relationship with my mother. What I want to express is joy. And I feel like I'm not allowed to do so. And so that conversation was just mind-blowing. And what resulted from that is us talking about how this work party was actually going to, it could be a wonderful opportunity for her to essentially create a personal grief ritual, to use it as an opportunity to go buy a bright purple dress and let the world know, I'm actually doing pretty well. And I feel like I can now express this specific emotion about what the loss of my mother means to me. And there are all sorts of other examples about how to get at anger as well, but maybe I'll get to that with one of the other categories.
And these are all great stories so far. And another category you have are rituals that create enduring connection. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that is easily one of my favorite type of rituals. And so again, you want to do some basic clinical assessment. Would it be beneficial to facilitate more of an ongoing bond and connection? Some individuals, for example, those with an insecure attachment style, and to get more specific, I actually very much need to get specific about that. Those who have a preoccupied or an anxious, ambivalent attachment style, what you might find is that they have too much continuing bonds. They are quite literally preoccupied with thoughts about the deceased. They go about their life having imaginary conversations with the person they lost all the time. Those individuals do not need this kind of ritual. It would quite literally be contraindicated, in my opinion. But some individuals would very much benefit from establishing a deeper sense of connection to the person that they lost. And again, since I'm alluding to attachment style, that is often the case for the other type of insecure attachment. Insecure avoidant attachment tends to result in people being a little too quick to move forward with their grief. They not only are failing to express emotions a lot of the time, but they're having a hard time accessing memories of the deceased and maintaining some kind of meaningful bond. Attachment style aside, you sometimes find that when you're talking to bereaved individuals, they simply express a desire for more of an ongoing bond, but they don't know how to do it. They don't know where to begin. And yeah, in those instances, I love to facilitate a conversation with them about what would allow you to feel connected to that person moving forward, whether it involves you wearing a piece of clothing that you inherited from them, using their golf clubs to go golf like you used to do together and feeling like you're essentially golfing with them. Endless examples, but one of my favorite examples of this is a client I worked with who really enjoyed traveling, and she found herself hesitant to do so after her mother died. And the more she and I talked about this, she started to talk specifically about going to the Taj Mahal in India. She was very hesitant to do so because she felt like it would just be a sad experience because she and her mother had always talked about how they wanted to go do that together. And unfortunately, they never had the opportunity to do so because her mother died before they had a chance to do so. So what she and I ended up talking about, what I invited her to consider, is the possibility that she could go and allow herself to experience that trip as if her mother was there with her. And that's exactly what she ended up doing. And she's gone on, I've been working with her for about 10 years now. She has had numerous experiences of travel now, where she goes and 98% of the trip has nothing to do with grief or mourning, but she always puts aside a little bit of time to walk up to the Arc de Triomphe in Paris or to go to the Taj Mahal, all with some illusory sense that my mom is here with me. She's seen this with me. I feel as if we can still travel the world together. She knows her mother is not literally there with her, right? She's not delusional. She's allowing herself some semblance of comfort and continuity by doing things with her mother. Brief side note on a very personal level, I cook Thanksgiving dinner for my family every year. And every single time I do that, at some point, my mother walks up to me and says, "Your grandma Martin is here with you right now. You realize that, right?" Practically brings me to tears right now just talking about it. And I actively embrace that. I love that opportunity every Thanksgiving to remind myself that half the reason why I love cooking is because of my grandmother. And I allow myself some sense of her being there with me when I'm holding the knife the way she taught me to hold it when I was 8 years old, when I'm making gravy the way that she taught us how to make gravy. And for me, that's my personal grief ritual. And I do it every single year.
It's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. And as you've been talking this hour, I have, as maybe our listeners have been doing, as you've been going through these categories, just playing out what that looks like and how I honor my father that I lost when I was 18 and now I'm 47. And so I think lots of people connect over food. And my father was a wholesaler of fruits and vegetable produce is some of the greatest restaurants in Louisville, Kentucky. So when we would celebrate as a family, we'd go and see his customers and it would be around meals. It is very special, a meal that brings back memories or a way of preparing food. So that example resonated with me. Your last category are rituals that embrace new life. We can end with a good story about how you help people with that.
First of all, I'd be remiss if I didn't say something about the importance of food in grief rituals. Humankind throughout history has intuitively understood that we have a deep emotional connection to food. And it's really interesting that no matter where you look around the globe and throughout human history, food is regularly incorporated into meaningful grief rituals. And so I quite literally ask my clients about food anytime we're considering the possibility of a grief ritual. Is there some kind of food that you want to tie into this that would be meaningful to you? Yeah, a lot of people intuitively understand that that's going to get at the emotions, or that's going to be the thing that helps them confront reality, or that's going to be the thing that helps them to feel an ongoing tie to the person and to the people that they've lost. As far as that last category of rituals that help us move forward and embrace new life, there are a lot of variations of that theme. For a lot of my clients, it quite simply involves us talking about intentionally stepping away from everything that's familiar and everything that does have some kind of meaningful connection to the deceased. Not that they need to abandon it forever, but maybe what they need is for us to talk about how they can create a grief ritual that intentionally and actively embraces something new about the future, something that allows them to move forward in a way that acknowledges this person was a part of my life in the past. I am now moving forward into experiences and relationships that don't have a meaningful tie to the past. And so for some people, it involves things as simple as, rather than take part in some kind of hobby or activity that reminds me of the person I lost, I'm going to take on a new hobby or a new activity. For some people, this involves breaking up old routines. A really simple example that always comes to mind is one of my clients lost his twin brother. And after talking with him about this for a while, it became apparent that one of the hardest things about his experience of mourning was that he and his brother met up every single Friday after work for a drink. That was their thing. And they had done it quite literally for 20 plus years, every single Friday. And so you can understand how every single Friday at 5 o'clock, he just had no idea what to do with himself. He even found himself going to that same restaurant and having a drink by himself. Now, part of what became concerning about this is that for one person, that would be great. This is what I find so interesting about the whole assessment process and trying to figure out what works for one person might not work for another person. For one person, this would shore up some sense of continuing bonds. Or maybe for another person, this would facilitate some kind of emotional expression that's being stifled. But when I talked to this guy, he found that he was going and it just felt meaningless. There were other things he wanted to do, but he almost felt a sense of allegiance to his brother. Like, I'm supposed to go to this restaurant every Friday, right? I'm supposed to have a drink here like we always used to do. It was the beginning of a conversation about how there were other things he wanted to do with his life now that he had this whole evening open to him for the first time in decades. And rather than me telling him what he should do with that evening, he started to entertain different ideas about how he wanted to learn to play an instrument, how there were friends of his that played as well, and he wanted to play with them. And so for him, the personal grief ritual was, for that chunk of time in the week, I'm not going to do anything that has anything to do with the fact that my brother and I used to get a drink every single Friday after work. I'm going to intentionally let that go, and I'm going to carve out time to do something completely new in my life that opens up room for new relationships and new experiences. That was the grief ritual for him. And as you can imagine, it was difficult. It took a lot of intention to put aside that time on Fridays to say, this is meaningful to me, and this is facilitating the mourning process because this is my way of saying, I am embracing what's new and open to me in life after my brother died. And then lo and behold, Fridays at 5 o'clock became something totally new for him. That was the time in the week where he actually played music with his friends. And I just found that to be so moving and frankly, just inspirational that it was difficult for him, but he knew that he needed to move forward with his life rather than remaining stuck in an activity that used to have meaning to him, but no longer did.
Yeah, what a powerful story. And again, I discovered you, Paul, even though we both have Chicago roots, we share the same publisher, Routledge. So I've actually, before I even reached out to you, have read and used Personal Grief Rituals. And again, I think even though Paul has a psychoanalytic background, his stories are relevant for systemic therapists working individually and with couples and families. And Paul, I will give you the last word. Anything else that we didn't cover that you want, maybe a takeaway for our listeners that are going to expand, as I said earlier, their scope of competence in working with grief and helping their clients with rituals? Any last parting words?
The full name of the book, and thank you, by the way. I really appreciate not only being invited to talk with you, and it's been really lovely, but I certainly appreciate you helping to promote the book. It is called Personal Grief Rituals, Creating Unique Expressions of Loss and Meaningful Acts of Mourning. And I guess the only thing I would leave your listeners with is just to reiterate some of the things that you and I have already talked about today. I think the most important thing to keep in mind, if you are helping a client design a personal grief ritual, is to make sure that you aren't telling them what to do, but to invite them to explore different ideas about two important things. First of all, what kind of symbols and activities are going to be most meaningful to them, right? Sight of a wooden cross in a church and the sound of clanging bells might be meaningful to some people, but for other people, it would be completely devoid of anything meaningful. And so it's absolutely crucial that we invite our clients to talk about and incorporate activities and symbols that mean something to them and provide commentary on the relationship they lost. And the second big thing to emphasize is this really clinical piece, which I talk about a lot in the book. We want to assess for what it is that the client needs in order to mourn in a more meaningful and a healthier way. That should be what the grief ritual centers on. And so for some individuals, it means they need more emotional expression. For some individuals, they need less. For some, they need to move forward with life and embrace more about what's new. For other individuals, they need to actually carve out more time to reflect on the past and to feel connected to the past. And lastly, some individuals are going to benefit from a greater sense of connection to the person that they lost. And for other individuals, they very much need the opposite. They need to come up with some way to distance themselves from the past. If you keep those two ideas in mind, what's most meaningful, what's going to cater to their psychological needs, that I think is going to guide you towards having a really fruitful conversation with your clients about how grief rituals can actually be helpful for them.
Eli, back with you, bringing to a close another informative installment of the AAMFT podcast. Did you know that AAMFT is active on all your favorite social media channels. Be sure to follow us, the AMFT, on Instagram, X, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And you want to stay up to date with everything going on in the world of AMFT, you can always find the back installments of the podcast anywhere you find your favorite podcast. I am partial to Apple Podcast and Spotify, but it's on Google Play, Stitcher. So please, if you're new to us, check out back installments where we tackle the latest trends and events impacting the world of systemic therapy, like today. And I have a number of pioneer interviews, which is some of my favorite interviews to conduct over the years. You can drop me a line at elikaram.com, where you see everything going on in my world, including two books that are out. One for our young professionals, Marriage and Family Therapy, National Exam, Your Guide for Success. That's from Springer. And that will prepare you for the national exam, including 360 practice questions, a full-length mock exam, proven strategies and tips for test taking, and it's organized to match the domains of the licensure exam. And then, if you're interested in these common factors that we always talk about on the show, including what makes a motivated client, how you build, nurture, and repair a therapeutic alliance, how you maximize your own therapist factors, you want to check out my book, Bringing Common Factors to Life in Couple and Family Therapy, from Rutledge. As always, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay systemic.
Hear the latest debate with our guests and topics we love.